The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Guy DeMann, and I'm here at The Guardian to talk to Richard Holmes about his new book, The Age of Wonder: How the Romantic Generation Discovered the Beauty and Terror of Science. Richard Holmes is the author of numerous biographies, most obviously of Shelley and Coleridge, and he's also won many plaudits and prizes for his work, including an OBE in 1992. Richard Holmes, you're known first and foremost, as we've just seen, as an authority on literary romanticism and its origins. What moved you in this direction to study the history of science all of a sudden?
Ah, yes. Was it sudden? Was it all of a sudden? I asked myself that. Biographers are really interested in the origins of things, including one's own books. And looking back at this, I can track, for example, at Cambridge. I was at Cambridge, but I went to the new scientific college, just founded, Churchill College. So 70% of the undergraduates there were scientists. So all my friends were scientists. So I learnt about things like motorcycle engines, as well as going to the observatory, Cambridge Observatory there, first time I used a big telescope. So there was a kind of latent interest in science anyway. And I think more particularly, one book, one biography often leads to another. And in the Coleridge biography, the young Coleridge's friendship with Humphrey Davy, the young scientist, not called scientist then, he was trained partly as a medical man and partly as a chemist. And he came to Bristol very young, when he was 20. And there was one of those sort of magic conjunctions. Robert Southey was there, Coleridge was there, and Davy was doing experiments with nitrous oxide, which is laughing gas. And he was working for a philanthropic institute, the Pneumatic Institute of Bristol, which was kind of an early concept of a sort of National Health Service clinic, really. And they were working with gases to see if they had therapeutic uses. They were actually trying to cure tuberculosis, among other things. And when I was studying Coleridge, I found he was invited into the laboratory by Davy. And Coleridge, who already had considerable experience of substances, notably opium, of course, was very interested to try the effect of nitrous oxide, which is a euphoric and so on, but also eventually makes you unconscious. So that was a beginning. So I'd kind of met Davy through Coleridge. And just to continue a moment longer, A little bit later, about 10 years, just 9 years later, their careers have taken very different paths. Davy, the young, brilliantly gifted scientist, had been taken up by Joseph Banks to London. He became the first director of the Royal Institution and proved to be an absolutely brilliant lecturer, okay, on not only chemistry but on electricity and so on. So much so, the institution's in Albemarle Street, and it became the first one-way street in London because so many coaches came. And he also had young women as well as young men among his audience. So he was a radical figure. He brings Coleridge, as I say, 8 or 9 years later, also to lecture at that institution. So to me, very interesting. No two cultures here. This is a completely cross thing. Coleridge is lecturing on the imagination and creativity, which, of course, now we understand very much is also a question of how it affects scientists and their creativity and so on. So there's a wonderful crossover. But, and I think this was a triggering thing, I found in the archives a manuscript letter of Davies describing how Coleridge suffered from the artistic temperament. Too much sensibility had caused chaos in his life. And if only, said Davy, he was more of a cool and rational and scientific man, his whole life would be better. And what's more, he would be more productive.
Mm. So in a sense, you do see it as entirely continuous with your work on Coleridge
Yes, completely. But I also, I'm in my early 60s now, and I felt that after the Coleridge book, which took 10 years, it'd be very easy just to settle down, do another literary, words about, another Byron biography and so on. And I just thought, no, I can't do that. I want to start again, because the great thing in biography is you start, ignorance is your great weapon. Start from a position of ignorance, because then the learning process feeds into the book. And I gradually felt, let me pick up those old scientific roots that went right back into my childhood and start trying to imagine how scientists go about things. And, there are parallels definitely between the way poets observe and write and sciences observe and write. They're not the same, but they're parallels. And I thought I can also write a biography which explores this. So, sticking in the Royal Institution, that is where Davy, sticking with him, later in life makes this wonderful technical breakthrough to invent the thing that every child has heard of, probably the only thing about Davy, the miner's safety lamp. And I thought, I'll really go in and look at this, see how it really happened, and tell it almost as you'd tell the way a poem arrives. What were the roots? Because there are roots. It's not a eureka moment. It goes deeply back into Davy's career. For example, he grew up in Cornwall, which is a mining region. He knew a lot about, it was tin mining down there, but he knew a lot about the kind of psychology of mining. And one of the key things for that discovery or that invention is that he himself will go down the mines in northern England. Then he begins an analysis of the gas, the methane, the lethal methane. Then he undertakes a series of brilliant and very dangerous experiments with his young apprentice, who's actually Michael Faraday. And he does not leave that laboratory. He irritates his wife almost beyond measure because he won't, as it were, come outside and enjoy Christmas. So you can follow the stages of that invention, and it is rather thrilling. And I've tried to write about that. And I make no difference between the fact that I'm writing about a scientific thing as opposed to a literary or a musical thing.
So, I mean, one of the things that brings us together is obviously involved in the title of the book. You call it The Age of Wonder. And I think you use this term wonder in a way to invoke the spirit of inquiry into the natural and human world that unifies both what's behind romantic literature and behind the science of the period and possibly all science, one could argue. Yet at the same time, you're also characterising the romanticism of Wordsworth and Mary Shelley and others as a kind of rejection of this very scientific worldview, this kind of inheritance of the Enlightenment. So what kind of balance was at work here? Do you see the reservations of the poets about the dissolving of mystery? Do you see that having played a formal part in the history of science?
Yeah, it's a good question. I would invoke, it seems to me there's a real shift, the kind of Thomas Kuhn idea of a paradigm shift takes place after Newton and before Darwin. It's this kind of lost period. It's two generations, really. And it seems to me that the science kind of changes its nature. It's not so much that they reject a Newtonian universe. There's some of the writers do. Goethe, it's very problematic, his view of Newton and his optical experiments and the whole notion that the rainbow has its mystery destroyed and so on. But in fact, because of the discoveries in astronomy particularly and chemistry, in short, William Herschel discovered a new planet, and suddenly the solar system looked entirely different, not a nice, fixed, cozy system, but something that could open up further and further. And more than that, and this is one of the things that I think is original and possibly even risky in the book, is it seemed to me, examining his papers, he saw clearly, long before Edwin Hubble, that there were galaxies, galactic systems outside the Milky Way at absolutely enormous, unimaginable distances. He talks about the millions of years that light from a star would take. He's got a notion of what we'd now call deep space and deep time very clearly in his papers. And there are wonderful moments when you find him trying to explain this. There's a young poet called Thomas Campbell who interviews him. And at the end, he says to Campbell, "So you realize from what I'm saying that the stars you're looking at are probably not there, and you're looking at a ghost universe," which is absolutely, and the poet goes away and walks on Brighton Beach, shakes his head, and quotes Newton about that we're all on the beach looking at the shells, but the great ocean of truth is all before us. So what I'm arguing there is that there was this shift that science seemed much more open, I think. And writers and also the ordinary public got much more engaged with it. The Newtonian science, remember, all the texts are written in Latin. It's very, very specialized. It's around this tight groove of the Royal Society. Whereas the people I'm talking about, this is the first generation of great public lectures, the huge, great debate that all the magazines carry on, vitalism. What is the life? Is there a life principle? Can surgery discover the soul? Is the soul an electric force? And of course, there we're beginning to move towards Frankenstein. Mm. But there's a lot of actually pure science behind that. And also, quite terrifying elements, like the experimental use of surgery. And one of the cases I have in the book is this extraordinary account of the writer Fanny Burney having a radical mastectomy operation without anaesthetic. Just to think about that makes one weak at the knees. But she describes it, a 10,000-word letter she writes in detail about her experiences. And she her reflections on it are very interesting. One being, could that much pain actually force the soul, whatever that is, out of the human body? So quite metaphysical questions are engaged with science. So it seems to me it's quite different. It's much more fluid. The new science has immediate impact on the public and on writers. Mary Shelley, of course, writes Frankenstein as a result of that. Mary Shelley's husband, Percy Bysshe Shelley, right from student days, fascinated by science, owns his own microscope, his telescope, writes many of the poems concern science, but also the notes to his poems concern the kind of cosmos that Herschel has described. Very interested in Humphrey Davy's chemistry. Both Mary Shelley and he had heard Davy lecture. And in fact, the great poems like Prometheus and Bound have a very powerful scientific undertext which shapes the imagery and so on. So again, a very close crossover and exchange of ideas. And I ought to add, of course, that Shelley was probably one of the most militant atheists of the period. And that atheism comes out of his scientific belief. And there is a huge subject which I feel reflects the kinds of discussion that are going on now. Mm. How much does science point you towards an atheistic belief, or how much is there room for what is now called intelligent design? This is a major debate, and it seems to me very clearly this started in the Romantic period.
There's also an interesting vision of the Frankenstein's monster as the source of poetry within that book, as the poet, which in a way links up nicely with your idea of Davy's cure for Coleridge's creativity, as if artistry itself was in need of some kind of cure, or as an expression of imperfection in some ways.
Yes, the notion that, as it were, the two sensibilities, and yet not, because I then need to add that Davy himself wrote a great deal of poetry. He was encouraged by Coleridge, and particularly by Southey, to do so. Southey, there are wonderful letters from Southey saying, keep up your poetry because it'll improve your science, which is, you know, what we want to hear.
Absolutely.
But Davy's, a lot of his more private doubts, theological doubts, moral doubts, metaphysical doubts, are in his poems, which get better as he gets older. And actually, his life, and one of the things I'm trying to do is show that scientists are not men and women in white coats. They have lives like all of us, very powerful, in this case, emotional lives.
So if I could just draw you backwards towards the framework of the book, in a way. It's notably, as a very nice conceit, it's framed by two famous sea voyages, which are themselves, in a way, kind of metaphors of man's partial kind of scientific mastery of the environment, the ability to navigate. So the two voyages are that of the botanist James Banks, who was on board Captain Cook's HMS Endeavour. And then towards the end of the book, you have as an endnote some discussion of course, Charles Darwin, who was on board Captain Stokes's HMS Beagle. So I wonder if you could just discuss very briefly what separates, in terms of the chronology of science, these two these two moments.
Yeah, big span there. Couple of dates. It's incidentally James Cook and Joseph Banks, okay? That's a nice allusion you made between the two. But Cook, Lieutenant James Cook is the one, they set out in 1768 and they get to Tahiti in 1769, which I write a great deal about because they spend a lot of time there. It's a kind of notion of paradise that is not paradise and so on. That's the beginning, a kind of innocent voyage in some ways, although actually it's disastrous in many ways, including the fact that half the crew die on the way back, including the fact that they, in fact, wreck without meaning to Tahitian civilization in a generation. So that's a kind of the innocent beginning. And then there are the two generations, really, in which various kinds, the voyage becomes a kind of metaphor that goes right through the book, because these are mental journeys as well as physical ones, and there are geographical explorations like Mungo Park in Africa, that tragic, powerful story. But also you feel Herschel, the Herschels, and it's not just William Herschel, it's Caroline as well. Very interesting brother and sister team, which I try and look at very closely, a kind of William and Dorothy Wordsworth of astronomy. They are making a kind of metaphysical void as well in their new notions of the cosmos. So that's a voyage. When you get to that young, what is going to be the first young Victorian generation, and of course it's Charles Darwin, but it's also Herschel's son, John Herschel. It's also people like Babbage. That group really grow impatient with the Royal Society. And one of the great things they do in the 1830s is form the British Association for the Advancement of Science, which incidentally, in its third meeting, coins the word scientist. Amazingly, that word did not exist before. And there's considerable discussion about what it means. And is it like atheist, for example? And who does it include? And at that conference, 1833 in Cambridge, it's an amazing lineup of people, including people like John Dalton, Michael Faraday, and also, perfect conjunction, the aged Coleridge turns up. So he comes back in the story, and he, in fact, is involved in defining this word scientist and what it might mean. So Charles Darwin is the only person who's not there because he's aboard the Beagle. So that next generation of voyages is taking place, and I argue that it's the beginning of the professionalization of science, really. It's also science... People like Herschel particularly begin to write about the philosophy of science, the notion of inductive science. They begin to look back at what has happened and develop an entire theory, which we would now recognize, about the whole notion of objective knowledge and how you come, as Lavoisier used to say, we step simply from the known, we step to the unknown. That is the process of science.
You have this notion that perhaps that in a way that the professionalization of science, as you call it, is in some ways, I mean, in some ways it's inevitable, in some ways something to be regretted, in the sense that perhaps is the moment when poetry and science or the creative imagination and the scientific imagination somehow begin to come apart. And, you know, evidently your book was written with a view to, in a way, showing how close they should be together in a way. Where do you think in today's society, does the onus lie with the artists, with the filmmakers and writers of books and the poets, or with the scientists and particularly those engaged in the popularization of science? Which side should be making more effort to bring these two things back together?
I mean, I hold a rather heretical view about this, that I think that the notion of two cultures was the aberration. That I think, in fact... in the 17th century, there was no division, and strongly in the Romantic period, there is no division. And the whole message of the book, the demonstration of the book, is how completely intertwined these processes are.
Yeah.
And I think it is true that somewhere at the end of the 19th century, some kind of division takes place. It may be a lot to do with Darwin, to do the shock that caused people. To take one example, that famous Edmund Gosse's book, Father and Son, which is about a father who's a passionate Plymouth brother, I think, who believes passionately in forms of creationism and so on, but is a scientist, and the son who is a complete skeptic. That clash of cultures, I think, helped to produce this separation. But I believe that's the aberration, and we are now moving back to a much more creative and kind of normal relationship between the two, because it's not only science popularization, but we have some of our finest writers now are writers of popular science, and they've got a very big readership. But it's also television and the internet. And more than that, I know you want to ask a further question, but more than that, it seems to me, because of certain, and I think this has happened really in the last sort of 15 years, because of the kind of environmental issues, notions of climate change, GM crops, that this whole panoply of future questions, where are we going, what's happening to the globe, that science has become more and more part of a necessary part of everybody's culture and dialogue and discussion. So that I feel they're coming together again exactly as they should do.
But then there's also a sense in which, by virtue of the professionalisation of science and by virtue of simply the nature of what is undertaken in scientific research, is that I can't look at what's being done in the latest physical research in physics and understand it at all. I need someone to translate it for me. But there's a sense in which back in the 1830s and 1820s, if I followed what someone like Darwin or Davy was engaged in, I could immediately understand both the value and implications of what was being conducted.
You can understand it now. But then it was as alarming as string theory is to us, as alarming as what's happening in CERN. You're right. We need explanations of what's going on. But that romantic period shows that it could be done. And when you have figures like Shelley or Coleridge as closely involved with people like Davy and Herschel, you see that this interchange could take place. And I think this is another much bigger question, but I've been very aware while writing this. There is a kind of crisis of science education here. And it's not only in Britain. It's quite widespread.
Right.
And there's a kind of disenchantment with science, which I think is absolutely perilous. And we need to recover that. It is as enchanting as anything else, believe you me. And it's one of the reasons why I wrote this book. And I would even go so far to say slightly missionary feeling, that I feel that biography, by opening up science through individual lives, not just of the men, but of the women, a very important part of this story, that is a way of kind of rebuilding that bridge. Follow an individual scientist's life, and not only the successes, but the errors, the mistakes, the tragedies, the dead ends. If you begin to understand that in the round, I think science begins to look like something else, and it looks very exciting, I think.
Richard Holmes, thank you very much for speaking to us.
It's been a great pleasure.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.